Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 295th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 294 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio show, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, www.johnmack13.com. Before getting into tonight's conversation, some announcements. First personal, my latest book, The Drum File, a short collection of poems dating back to 2009 and a short story all revealing my feelings for the present occupant of the White House, is now available on Amazon, both in print and in Kindle formats. Additionally, I am in the middle of editing the Hudson Valley Anthology 2019, a collection of the writing of slightly over 60 of today's writers. I am shooting for its release from the end of the month through mid-November. Then now, some local Hudson Valley news. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 23rd year, at 6:30 p.m. in a Mahopac library on 6 in Mahopac, surprisingly. More than 175 books have been published by writers from that group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So October's meeting will be on Wednesday, October 16th at 10 a.m. at the Hill Boulevard Diner, which is on Hill Boulevard, just west of Route 6 in Jefferson Valley. There are also two poetry workshops in the area, open to both fledgling and experienced poets, one in Mahopac and one in Yorktown. The Mahopac one is held on the second Wednesday of the month at the Mahopac Library at 6:30, and the Yorktown one is on the fourth Wednesday at the John C. Hart Library in Trib Oak, New York at 6 p.m. In October, the Mahopac, the workshop the next meet on Wednesday, October 9th, while the Yorktown one will meet next on Wednesday, October 23rd. If you're confused by the groups and dates, just email me at johnmack13@gmail.com. Finally, the October open mic session of the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center will be on Friday, October 18th, in the scenic Philip C. Manor train station overlooking the Hudson in Sleepy Hollow, New York. There will be the featured artist followed by an open mic session. The theme of the October open mic will be Halloween horror, but readers are not bound by the theme. A complete guide to all of the center's many offerings may be found at writercenter.org. That's WRITERSCENTER, one word, .org. Anyone wishing more information on any of these may once again contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. Those who are listening to the show last week know it was an unmitigated disaster. I was supposed to have an old friend, documentary producer, agricultural economist, and consultant to foreign countries, Dr. Charles Chip Mann, as my guest. And unfortunately, no matter what we did, I was not able to establish contact with him. So the show turned into me playing music and reading some poetry. For a few days, I was unable to reach Blog Talk Radio and was extremely frustrated and actually looking at other services. And then I received the following from the Blog Talk Radio help desk. These issues have been fully resolved, and the platform is up and running properly. We have been suffering from an abnormal system overload that we believe has been caused by a denial of service attack on the telephony system. Our engineers have put in place countermeasures to mitigate it from happening in the future, and are still investigating to secure our system even further. I verified that, and in fact, all seems to be working properly, and I've rescheduled Dr. Mann for 2 weeks from tonight on October 20th. Next week, October 13th, my guest will be Gary Axelbang, publisher of the news and information and website This Is the Bronx, and the host of Bronx Talk and the Bronx Buzz on BronxNet. And finally, to tonight's show. My guest on tonight's show, the 295th in the series, as mentioned, is another old friend, educator, author, photographer, and most recently, historian, an online newsletter publisher, George Robinson. I first met George probably over 20 years ago when we were teammates in the local basketball league, and we are now members of the Mahopac Writers Group, and I'm a subscriber to his online newsletter. The listeners wishing to join George and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Good evening, George, and welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Thank you, John.
Now let's start right at the beginning. Where'd you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in the Bronx. I went to St. Nicholas of Tallentine, right on Fordham Road, University Avenue. We had the Dominican nuns and the Augustinian fathers.
Do you remember what your interests and earliest aspirations were?
In grammar school?
Yeah.
To play Little League baseball is probably the biggest one. Yeah. School was just something to get through.
And then where'd you go to high school, and did your interest change then?
They certainly did. Because I was good in math, I did well on the city test to get into school, so I ended up at Fordham Prep. There I played sports, football, basketball, and baseball, but I also got a good Jesuit education.
I know that you were a Journal American All-City quarterback in your junior year, but you were really an end on the team. How did that happen?
That was very interesting. In my junior year, I was all set to be an end, and then 1 week before the start of the first game against St. John's, our first-string quarterback broke his collarbone. Second-string quarterback had to get out, had a cyst in his back or something like that. And the third-string quarterback was just a sophomore who really didn't know what he was doing. So the coach came to me and said, I'd like to make you quarterback. I said, sure. I thought that would be great. We know all the I hated. I started to learn how to take a snap from center and throw quickie passes and do some handoffs, rather. And I was pretty successful with it. And our team went undefeated, untied, unscored upon in league competition. And that was a good year for me.
And what did you do the next year? Did you stay as a quarterback, or did you go back to end?
I alternated back and forth. We got our real quarterback who could really throw, and I could catch his passes. But if something went wrong, they put me in every now and then. So I was a backup quarterback, but basically I liked my position. And those were the days when you played both ways. So the first 11 guys were the 11 guys on the field for the most, playing both offense and defense.
And then what happened after high school?
I guess somebody saw me play and thought I was pretty good and hoped for a scholarship. So I went up to Worcester, Massachusetts, and I played ball for 4 years. And I also picked up a strange sport. I picked up lacrosse.
You're fading in and out just a
sorry,
bit.
I'll repeat one. I went up to Holy Cross, Massachusetts. I played football. I even caught one pass in my sophomore year. Then they switched me over to defense. And in the springtime, to stay in shape, instead of playing baseball, I played lacrosse.
And was lacrosse the big sport at the cross then, or no?
No, it was more a club sport. It didn't become an official sport for a number of years. But it was still a lot of fun.
Then what did you major in at lacrosse?
I was an English major. The reason I was an English major at the time, I was rebelling against my father. He was a mathematician. He was an accountant. And even though math is what got me into college, with those grades that I had there, I decided I would rebel and become an English major. The same reason I didn't play baseball, because he was a semi-pro baseball player, I decided to play lacrosse. And those were decisions I made back then. I just wish somebody had slapped me upside the head and said, no, math and baseball would be better.
Well, yeah, you are going in and out at times. Maybe the phone's moving away.
I don't know why. I'm speaking right into the iPhone.
And then what did you do after college?
What did I do after college? Low draft number. And it was somewhat. So rather than go into the Army, I joined the Air Force. And I thought I was being smart by joining the Air Force because I don't think I'd get to Vietnam anytime soon. That was a mistake because they said, you're a college graduate. You're an English major. We have just the job for you. And it was teaching English as a foreign language to Vietnamese officers in beautiful downtown. The reason I did that, they had to have their English level at a certain proficiency so that they could come back to the United States and take the pilot course. The idea was we would train Vietnamese pilots to come back and fly the plane, and our American pilots wouldn't have to fight in the war. That was the plan.
Was it in Vietnam that you got in, into diving and underwater photography, or do those interests come before or after?
Later.
Okay.
Later. In Vietnam, I had my father's old camera, and I was just taking pictures of my students, and then going downtown in Saigon, taking pictures of the Vietnamese girls in their ao yai, the clothes. And they also had
Maybe you should put the speaker on. Maybe you should put the speaker on. How long were you in the service after Vietnam? What did you do when you got back in the States?
I did two tours in Vietnam. And when I came back, I had 2 years left to go. I was assigned to Griffith Air Force Base up in Rome, New York. I started out as an information specialist. I was with the newspaper people. And then one day they asked if I would be the wing historian. Apparently the person they had in the job really didn't know his name and didn't spell well. Those were the days before you went order correction. So they asked me if I would do the job. So I became a wing historian, and I learned how to everything, including top secret messages. That was an interesting thing. When I got out, I applied for a job as an English teacher. And I got one. I got a number of offers, but I wanted to come back to Westchester. And I got a job at Mount Pleasant Central Schools teaching middle school English.
Had you always planned to be an educator, or did that come later?
No, I didn't plan on it. It just sort of happened with an English degree. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. My wife helped me a little bit before I went to the Air Force. I went to City College of New York. I had a program for teachers to teach in New York City schools. But I went to the Air Force.
I was also an English major, and of course, you don't know what you're going to do with that other than go on for a PhD. And to the grace of God, I became an information technology person, something that I knew absolutely nothing about while I was in college or even after that. So, and that carried me for years. Take us through your career as an educator, if you would.
Okay. I taught grade 6 through 12 English. Then I got involved with a science teacher. And at the time, I got involved with the Griffin-Townsend program. The reason I got involved with the Griffin-Townsend program was I taught the gifted and talented teacher. I would come in and I would help out. And we act out plays, etc. And when she got a different job, she recommended me. And I had no idea really what to do with gifted and talented education except create something new and present it to an audience. But I got involved with that and went to school up in the University of Connecticut to get more education to learn how to do it. But while I was in Westlake Middle School, we had a science teacher, Steve Tussock, and he was doing some interesting programs, sort of like what I was promoting for gifted and talented education. And what he wanted to do was take students down to Key Largo to go diving and count fish. We would do it as part of the reef organization's fish count. And we would go down and have lectures on fish identification, and people would come in from universities and talk about seagrass, and we did those kinds of things. He was the diver, I was the snorkeler, so I took the students and just snorkeled, and then one day when we had some rough weather and I was on the top with the waves, I was complaining about how rough the waves were. He told me, well, under the ocean, there's no waves. That's when I decided to get a certification in scuba diving. And then I started to take underwater pictures of what we were doing. And that's when the water photography started, and my love of jumping in the water and taking pictures of fish.
And then you wound up in different colleges and different schools too. How did you get to CNR and other places?
While I was at Westlake, I had taken a course up at a whole program at the University of Connecticut for the master's degree. They invited me to continue into their PhD program, and they were offering me an internship. You know, I wouldn't have to pay. But I still had a job back in Mount Pleasant. So we talked it over with the superintendent and the principal, and they allowed me to have a sabbatical to go up to Utah and find a PhD in educational psychology. I did that. I stayed around for a few more years working with the gifted program in the English department, and then time to retire. I didn't retire. I had an offer to go to the College of New Rochelle to be the assistant dean of their graduate school.
Then, of course, there is no more College of New Rochelle now, unfortunately.
No, that's gone. It was
And how long did you stay there?
I was there about 5 years, and it was time for me to go. I'd done what I wanted to do there. I was in charge of the co-sponsored programs, which means we were connected with the different teacher centers. There was about 20 of them, 28 of them around Long Island, upstate New York, down in New York City. And we offered our graduate school programs, administration programs, special ed programs, ESL programs to them, and they would take them at their site and come during the summer to make up the required courses on campus. And I was in charge of going around and administering and making nice with the students and the administrators at the teacher center. I had enough of driving around. I left that job, and I went to work for Renzulli Learning, with the differentiation. And I did a lot of professional development in New York City and up at the East Coast on that program.
And it was also, take you back to CNR, it was at CNR that you met Vinnie DiQuino, who runs our writers group. Isn't that true?
Vinnie was in charge of the teacher center at Pelham High School, and that was just down the road from where we were. He's one of my stops, and I got to know him well. We interacted many times, and then I was surprised when I met him up here, and he invited me to join the writers group.
And then you also did some time down in Florida as an educator, didn't you?
Yes.
What got you down there, and why did you come back to the nicer weather?
Up and running, but then after a while, the climate didn't agree with me, and I had to come back. But it was a great opportunity to start a gifted program from scratch and put in all the good philosophical ideas that you should have for a gifted program. And right now it's running very well. I look on it every now and then, look at their website, and they're doing very well in the state. So I'm happy to have started it.
See, I don't do the really hot weather very well. My son says it's because of my cheap Irish skin. So and now let's move to the writing. We'll start at the beginning and come up to your present project,
okay.
or your almost present project. And please explain the interest in the coral reef and the Everglades.
As I said, when I started with Stephen Pesek back in the, I guess it was the 90s, and we were taking students down every year. We'd go down for about 5 days or a week and take pictures of the reef. And so I wanted to learn how to do it.
and you start off with a rented camera, and then you start buying your own, and you get more and more elaborate with your underwater housing. And I also got more elaborate with my diving. I became a dive master so that I could be a better diver under the water. And then I took lots and lots of pictures. And my wife said, what are you going to do with all these pictures? And on one trip, we were down in the Bahamas, took a picture of an angelfish. And it was just made a turn toward me right behind a purple coral. And it was just like a beautiful picture. I said, that's what I'm going to do. A is for angelfish. I can write a children's book, and I'll start with A is for angelfish. I know B is for butterfly fish. C is for clownfish. So I think that's what I'm going to do. I made a book out of that, a children's book. I also worked with my wife. She was a reading specialist, my wife Janet, and we did another book on the coral reef for young children, explaining the habitat and prey and predators. And so I took the pictures, and I initially wrote it, but she translated it back into second gradese. And that was, at least 10 years, more than 10, 12 years that we've been receiving royalties from that book still. So that was a great idea. But one of the things, you can't dive all day. So while I was down in the Florida taking these pictures, I got involved with the Everglades, and I went around different times taking pictures of the Everglades. And again, I masked a number of pictures. And once again, I decided it would be another ABC book. I did an ABC book, ABC Guide to the Everglades, and that was exciting. And I had a friend of mine, he challenged me. Oh, that's a nice book. I thought this would be good in Spanish. Could you do this in Spanish? And since I'm a person who will take on almost any challenge, and just because I don't know how to do something doesn't mean I won't try it, and my Spanish was very limited, but that didn't matter. So I started it, and then I realized that the words didn't match up in English. My butterfly fish was no longer a B. It was an M, Mariposa. And that affected about 10 or 12 pictures, and I had to rearrange them. I had to go down and take some new pictures. And luckily, I have in-laws who are from Argentina, and they took my rough Spanish and smoothed it out and made it into more literate Spanish. So I had those two books, and I thought that was really neat.
Yeah, it's still. You also mentioned in your notes to me that you did the editing of a grandfather's memoir. Now, was that published in his lifetime, or would that come after he passed away?
After he passed away. In his 80s, or late 70s, 80s, he decided to sit down and write about his life. And he wrote in a, I guess it was called an Indian tablet. It was just a yellow pad. And he wrote in old man script. That's the only way I could describe it. And it was a flowing Palmer method, but it was a little shaky. And he filled up three notebooks. So before, and it was always rumored that there was a lot of information there, and nobody really did anything with it. My mother had them, and eventually she sent them to me, and I sat around for a while. Then one day I started to read them and said, this is interesting, but first I got to translate them and put them into print and put them on the computer. That took a long time. I had my secretary help me out, and I typed a lot. I got it in. And then I could edit it down to make it more readable by putting in settings. I added a lot of pictures, family pictures, and when he mentioned places, I took those pictures. His title of his book was The Autobiography of an 1898 Dropout. He was 10 years old when he dropped out of school. The reason being, his father was, well, his last name is DeLuna, and his father came from, came from Cuba, as well did his grandfather. And so the connection with Cuba is very strong, And I have to start off with my great-great-great-great-grandfather. And he was a person who was involved with trying to get the Spanish out of Cuba. He was a Cuba Libre. And the Spanish wanted him out of the country. So they eventually arrested him. They put him in the castle, Muro Castle in Havana. They don't know what they were going to do with him. But his friends helped him escape. They put him in a hog's head barrel and shipped him off to New York. And he was there. And so my great-grandfather was also interested in helping Cuba be free, and he was involved with getting an enlistment of men to go down and do some freedom fighting just before the Spanish-American War. And so he was on his way down there, and he was basically assassinated. His head was cut off somewhere near Atlanta.
Wow.
Over his head, but that was just the cover story. Spanish assassins had got him. So he ended up being orphaned at 10 years old, dropping out of school, and doing all sorts of odd jobs to keep him, his brother, and his mother, sufficient. And he tells that story, and it's all from the 1890s up until 1970 about his life and everything. So I published it. I published it for my family. We ended up putting it online and publishing it. And that's the story of Mario Juan Bellino de Luna.
Is it still available on Amazon or someplace?
You can get it on Amazon. It's called. I called it a Luna. A Luna saga. Yes, it's available.
As you know, I think you're. Your present project is fascinating. The one about, before the newsletter. Please describe it in detail and explain, A, how you got into it, and second, the work that has gone into it.
You're talking about my manuscript?
Yes, I am.
Okay. My manuscript, I just found out that technically it's a manuscript until it gets published and then it's a book. My manuscript is called Silent No Longer, the Central Park Statue Speaks. And what I did, or how I got involved with it, I would walk through Central Park and I'd see all these statues and I'd go, who are these guys? And there'd be a little plaque on them and tell you a little bit of information, but it was just like, I don't know anything about these people. Especially the one going by, the statue of King Jagiełło, who is a 14th century Polish king. He has a monster statue. He's on a horse. He has two swords raised over his head, crossed, just down a little bit on from Museum of Metropolitan Museum of Art, right on Fifth Avenue, around 72nd, 74th Street. And he's, why is he here? So I wanted to investigate why those statues were here, and I wanted to tell their story because that's what I think I am best at doing. Is not a teller of stories, but a reteller of stories. So I had the idea for a book, and I wanted to have it as a conversation because it's so quiet around the statues. I needed them to talk to us and tell us about why they're there. Who went to the expense to put up a statue of these people? I mean, it started with, I can't remember. It started, the first one was Schiller. He was like 1858 or something like that. And the last one is
the musician.
I got to look at my notes now. Who's the musician?
I forget.
I got 20 statues. There's about 29 statues. There's several benches. There's also tree markers. And there's an obelisk. There's a stone mosaic. Who are these people? And that's what I wanted to know. So I didn't invent the idea. I came up with the idea that the statues would speak. They'd be connected to the internet. And like Siri and Alexis, they would. They could talk to us. So I had four high school students going around asking them about themselves, who they are, what they did, and they would also ask them mean, rotten, and nasty questions. So they asked Hamilton, why didn't you run for president? He had some dark secret. What was it? They asked General Sherman, should you be brought up on war criminal charges for what you did marching through Atlanta? So I have them those kinds of things. They even asked Christopher Columbus if he's a guilty of genocide. But with, in addition to doing that, they revealed their stories in conversation form. And so I collected all the stories. I didn't collect the stories. I went and did a lot of research, a lot of reading, and tried to put it in easy-to-understand terms. And that's my book, Silent No Longer, or I hope it's a book, Silent No Longer, The Central Park Statues Speak.
And you spent a lot of time not only doing the research, but reworking the way that you were doing it, both as a narration and almost as a screenplay and back to narration. And it was all, it's been very interesting both to watch the book develop because of the research and the changes that you made to the style based on what other people told you and you thinking it over and then going back to the drawing board. So how long has the whole book been in progress?
About 2 years. I originally started taking pictures. Again, I was having done a couple of ABC books. I was going to do an ABC book of Central Park. But then I lost all my pictures through the cyberspace. And then my wife says, well, why don't you write a book like the one that our grandchild likes to read on, what's the name of it now? I Survived. That's the name of it. The titles were I Survived. I Survived the Chicago Fire. I Survived the San Francisco Earthquake. I Survived 9/11. Which I thought was brilliant because, you know, it's going to have a happy ending. And she said, why don't you do a series of books like that? And I said, what am I going to do? I can't think of anything. And that's when I thought of the Central Park statue. And I went back and took pictures of the statue. So each chapter has a picture of the statue. And what I originally wanted to do was have it in dialogue form, almost like a screenplay. And so the characters would, the name would be there, and there'd be a semicolon, and they'd speak their words. I tried to get agents to, look favorably upon it. And one agent did me a favor and said, this is not going to work. People don't really want screenplays. You need to have a narrator. And that hit a light bulb went off, and he said, that's a good idea. So I changed the whole format so I have a narrator, but the students are still speaking. And I used James Joyce's method of quotations. He hated quotation marks, just like I do. So instead of quotation marks, he just has like a dash when people start speaking. And the narrator is in italics. So I did it that way.
And then this project brought you even the more recent one is the newspaper publisher. First, what was the interest that had to do that? And second, to why'd you take it online as a newsletter?
I'm in the car a lot, and I used to drive, and I still do. I drive by road signs, and I do a quick head turn and go, what did that say? And my wife says, I don't know. And then we go further, and you see a statue, and you go, who's that guy? And you keep going. And so it always intrigued me of all these historic road signs, and nobody's really knows what they say. They're there, but you can't. If you're walking, you can take your time and read them. If you're driving, a little more difficult. So I decided to take my camera, because that's how I realized how I write. I take a photo first, and then I write about the photo. And I would stop at the road signs, take their pictures, and then I would research them. And what I've been doing is putting together in a little
storyline. So like the first online newsletter that I have was about Danbury burning. It starts with, of course, Sybil Ludington, but then the whole story of why the British came up the first place, what they wanted to do, which was to burn all the supplies that were being gathered in Danbury, and then go back, and our troops came and forced them, and there's signs all around Danbury, there's road signs in Ridgefield, and some interesting pictures that will be taken at the Killer Tavern in Ridgefield. If you go around the back and you lift up a little flap in the on the siding, you'll see an old cannonball that was part of the attack on Ridgefield. So I put that together as a statue. And the other one I did was spies. Road signs about Crosby, about Andre, and I did a story about them, and one of my friends said, oh, you should include Arnold. And he had a picture of Arnold's boot up in Saratoga that I included in that newsletter. The story about Arnold's boot, he was really responsible for the success of that battle, and he lost his leg there. Well, they wanted to reward him with keep his memory alive, but they didn't want to give him a full statue because he was a traitor. So they just said, we'll honor his leg. And so there's a statue to his boot that's up there. And so I'm continuing doing different historical road signs and statues as I travel around. I have when I was in Sacramento, I discovered I wasn't planning on taking pictures there, but there was the Pony Express. There was the start of the Union Pacific Railroad. There was the fort Sutter, with Sutter's Mill, and there's a whole story there. So I took pictures, and that'll be one that's coming up at a later time.
How did someone get your newsletter?
I made a website, because that's what you have to do to be noticed. And on my website, where I have different photographs of my animals and birds and underwater photography. I have a number of some of my writings there. But I have a sign up for my newsletter. And when you sign up for my newsletter, I give you a reward of an online download of my book, ABC's Guide to the Everglades. So you get that, and then you sign up. And then once every 2 weeks, a new newsletter comes and graces your iPhone. What I've also been doing is putting up past issues of my newsletter, so if you want to miss them or you sign up late, present it beforehand.
So what's the URL of the way in to that?
That's my name, GeorgeJRobinson.com. I try to keep it simple and easy to remember.
Okay. It gets interesting. You're talking about those signs. I mentioned of Vinnie D'Aquino earlier. Well, his passion for the last 20 years on Sybil Ludington and two books was all started by him writing by the sign and saying, who was that? And eventually going to the Mahopac Library and meeting the clerk there who took him to the records there, Andy Campbell, and that started his two books going, and I think that's extremely interesting. How that many people just drive by these things, all the ones around Westchester with Major Andre and where he was caught, you know, and everything like that. You know, they're all over the place.
Yes.
So.
And a lot of things you don't notice until someone brings it to your attention. A while ago, someone said, have you ever noticed how many red Volkswagens there are driving around town? And I hadn't. And then all of a sudden I looked and it seemed to be everywhere. Once you start thinking about road signs and statues, they seem to pop up just about everywhere.
what's next for you?
I was thinking of another book, but this one I wanted to do on women, just women statues. And it seems like New York City is helping me out. They're going to put up 7 new ones. Right now there's 5 women statues around New York City. They want to put up 7 more. When I did my Central Park book, there are no real women statues there. It's Alice in Wonderland. Okay, it's Romeo and Juliet. It's Mother Goose. They are putting one in July 2020 on the Suffragettes, and that should be the start of, I think, good things for women and their statues. I think women only have 5 to 7% of all the statues that are erected in the United States.
Well, that whole project has had tremendous controversy because they opened it up to a vote by historians, and the person who was number one on everyone's list was Ann Seton, Mother Seton, and then the people in charge not only dropped her off, but they dropped off 3 other people, and because they're concerned with the underrepresentation of minorities, and they dropped out two of the high vote getters, and I don't know whether that's been resolved yet, has it?
I don't think so, but I think that's a great excuse to have a second wave of statues to be presented and placed in a park somewhere. One of the things I noticed, there are a lot of women, not full statues, busts that I have to go down and take photos of in the Hall of Fame Terrace, which used to be NYU School, is now Bronx Community College, down in down in the Bronx. And I want to go take pictures of the women statues there. A lot of them are educators, successful women. And they just seem to be not promoted enough. So I think that's another area I want to get into, especially women's statues.
Okay, that's in University Heights there. Now, I know that Westchester, the Bronx Community College, keeps maintaining the Hall of Fame, but do they keep adding people the way NYU did, or is it a closed group?
I don't know. That's why I want to go down there and find out.
We've touched a lot of the bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
I don't think any new ones have been added in a while.
Okay. I think we talked over each other because I was having some difficulty hearing you. We've touched a lot of the bases tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
Search and rescue. I just had my membership changed. I'm no longer an active member. They just made me a lifetime member. But for 10 years, I jumped in murky water with 2 or 3 inch disability training, so that if I had to go look for a body or a firearm or something, I was prepared. We did have some calls to that effect, and I'm proud of that service. And lastly, I just hope that people would go to my website, find out a little bit more about me, and sign up for my newsletter, and just go to georgejrobinson.com.
So thank you very much, George. It's been a real pleasure.
You're welcome.
Send any comments or questions about the show or for any URLs to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And be sure to join me next week for my conversation with Gary Axelbank. Go to my website for the URL of previous shows, and my books are available on Amazon, as are George's, as we just found out. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Until next time, let's just say in the old neighborhood, see ya. And let's go off with the Eagles again, as we have the last few weeks. Amazon, play Taking It Easy.
Playing Take It Easy from your library on Amazon Music.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.